So welcome, everybody. Welcome to our Facebook Live audience. And today I have to warn you, today's going to be complicated. I gave you a little hint last week. We're starting chapter three today. I gave you a little hint last week about certain things seem to be a bit out of order. And so I'm going to read through parts of most of chapter three, and I'm going to point out some questions. And what we're going to have to do today is try to solve the questions, okay? Again, I say it's going to be a bit complicated, but we're going to do our best, all right? So first of all, we started a bit of chapter three last week. We really just went to the first two verses. Early next morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out from the Shittim, marched to the Jordan. They did not cross immediately, but spent the night there. So at the end of 3 days, the officials went through the camp and went through the camp. Okay, and then we have what they charged the nation. If you'll notice, we talked about this idea of the 3 days. And how the idea of 3 days is three is an archetypal number and very often refers to a time of preparation. And this 3 days, okay, this is at the end of a 3 day period. And the 3 day period actually begins at the very beginning of Joshua. Joshua 1, we see starting in verse 10, that Joshua commands the officials and he's telling them, go through the camp, command the nation or charge the people thus, get provisions ready for in 3 days' time, you are to cross the Jordan in order to enter and possess the land that the Lord your God is giving you as a possession. So when we go to chapter three and we read in verse two, at the end of the 3 days, it's the same 3 days. It's the 3 days that they were given warning. It's also the same 3 days that we learned in chapter two is the time where the spies were there with Rahab and then they hid and then they came back. All that also happened during the same 3 day period. So it's a time of preparation and we have two scenes, the scene of the nation camped ready to cross. They're getting ready during the 3 days and during the same 3 days, the spies are getting organized. Okay, now we go on to, we continue what we've been reading in chapter three. Okay, they commanded the people. Okay, the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp. That's verse two. Verse three is like a continuation of that verse, and they commanded the people: as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priest, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. In other words, he's giving instruction, the ark is going to go first, okay? Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. So we start out with an instruction by the officials, and they are essentially warning the people to keep on the one hand to follow the ark. The ark is leading the march, and yet to keep distance from the ark. And we know that that is a direct connection to the things that we studied when we studied the building of the tabernacle and the ark back in Exodus. It was the same idea. Don't touch it. Don't get near it. And this is very, very important. Now, then we have the next verse, verse six. Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. Verse seven, the Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. Now, I have a question about this, okay? It says in verse six that Joshua commands the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people. However, it is only in verse seven that we learn that God commands Joshua to tell the priests to bear the Ark of the Covenant. You come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. Okay? So it's a little odd that we have Joshua first telling the commanding the priests about the Ark of the Covenant, and only afterwards finding out that God commanded Joshua to tell the priests something about the Ark of the Covenant. So that's my first question. We're going to see similar questions as we continue. Verse 9. And Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing before you into the Jordan. Now, therefore, take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man, and when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Lord of all the earth shall rest in the waters of the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. So when the people set out from, okay, so let me just stop here for a moment. And here we have Joshua commanding the people of Israel, telling them about how they're supposed to go forward, behold the Ark of the Covenant, etc. And he's telling to them, pay attention to verse 12. Now, therefore, take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man. And he's telling them that they're supposed to do something when they come into the land. Okay. And take the 12 men to the tribes. And then it says, when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark, okay, the waters will stand. And then if we come further, okay, we'll stop here for now. Again, we have an odd situation, because if we go forward to chapter four begins, actually, the first verse is a very strange verse. It says, when the entire nation had finished crossing the Jordan, chapter three ends with the nation crossing the Jordan. Chapter 4 begins connecting to that, and when they finished crossing the Jordan. And then we have the Lord said to Joshua, select 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe. And it struck them as follows. Pick up 12 stones from the spot exactly in the middle of the Jordan where the priest's feet are standing. Take them along with you and deposit them in the place where you will spend the night. Okay? Again, we have the same question. Joshua has already, in verse 9, commanded this, take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man. Okay, and then he moves to talk about what happens when the priests sit there. But he's already commanded these 12 men that they're supposed to do something. Okay, but God actually commands Joshua on this issue later in chapter 4. Again, it seems very out of order. It doesn't make a lot of sense, okay? So these are the, oh, and I have one more similar question. We're going to continue now into chapter 4, okay? Chapter 4, let's look at, start with verse 8, okay? And the people of Israel did just as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, just as the Lord told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to the place where they lodged and laid them down there. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan in the place where the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant had stood. And they are there to this day. For the priests bearing the Ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished, that the Lord commanded Joshua to tell the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua. The people passed over in haste. Okay, that is verse 10. Now look at verse 11. When all the people had finished passing over, the Ark of the Lord and the priests passed over before the people, the sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, the half-tribe of Manasseh, passed over armed before the people of Israel. Moses told them about 40,000 ready for war, passed over before the Lord for battle. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they stood in awe him, just as they stood in awe of Moses all the days of the life. Okay, so we have already What do we have? We have in verse 11, when all the people had finished passing over the ark of the Lord and the priests passed over before the people. Okay, so we have already in verse 11 that the people finished crossing, they passed the ark of the Lord, and then the priests also had passed. They go forward. Then look at verse 15. The Lord said to Joshua, command the priests bearing the ark of the testimony, come up out of the Jordan. So Joshua commanded the priests, come up out of the Jordan. But in verse 11, we already learned that they passed before the people and they had come out of the Jordan. So we have three situations where seemingly these verses seem to be in strange order, where Joshua has given commands to the nation in advance of God telling Joshua what he's supposed to do. It makes sense that God would first tell Joshua what to command the nation, and only afterwards Joshua would then command the nation or the priests or the officials or whatever, what God told him to do. And yet these verses seem to be written out of order. Now, Kim, if you could put up that document that I gave you. I am now going to share a screen. I have taken the liberty to reorder these verses. And I want to read them through, and I think you will find they make a lot more sense. Now, not to worry, in case some of you are getting uncomfortable. I am not suggesting that God made a mistake. I am not suggesting that there was some messy editors. You know, you have Bible critics that ask these questions all the time. And what's their solution? It was a messy editor. There was a fragment from here and a fragment from there, and some people put it together in a messy order. Trust me, I am not suggesting this. What I am suggesting, and this is something that, by the way, there was a rabbi in Israel, his name was Rabbi Mordechai Breuer, that he did some very brilliant things. This is not from him, but his idea is what has given me this approach. And many, many Bible scholars in Israel today were influenced by this approach. Basically, what this rabbi did is he asked the same questions that the Bible critics ask. Places where you have things repeated more than once, where you have inconsistencies in a text, where you have things that seemingly out of order. The answer of the Bible critics have been, this is man-made, different versions of the same story, and they just kind of put it together in a hodgepodge, and that's what you get. Rabbi Breuer said, no, this is not a hodgepodge. This has been written like this on purpose. And the reason for it is going to be because it's giving us an extra level of message. And so we're going to take that same approach and we're going to look at it. So first of all, I have reordered the verses and what I think makes a lot more sense in terms of the chronological order. Okay, so I start with chapter 1, verse 10, just to give us we kind of did this already. Joshua commanded the officers of the people, pass through the midst of the camp and command the people, prepare your provisions, for within 3 days you are to pass over this Jordan to go and to take possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. That's like the background. In the middle, we have other stories. Now we're coming back to the story. Chapter 3, then Joshua rose early in the morning, they set up from the Shittim, they came to the Jordan. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people. Okay, what happens? The first 3 days, during that time, they're telling everyone to get prepared. Okay, and that's the beginning. They have 3 days to prepare. And now at the end of the 3 days, the officer again go through the camp and they tell them, what are they telling them? Be careful when the ark goes in front of you, keep your distance. Now look what I did. I took verse 7 and put it before, verse 7 and 8, put it before verse 6. The Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all of Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. And Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant, pass on before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. And again, I went to chapter 4 and I put this part first. The Lord said to Joshua, take 12 men from the people, from each tribe a man, and command them, saying, take 12 stones from here, out of the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you, and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight. And Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here, listen to the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, here's how you shall know the living God is among you, blah, blah, blah. verse 12, now therefore take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe of men. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing. The waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. Okay. And so then we see that they actually passed before. That's in verse 14. Okay. And then we have in verse 17, now the priest bearing the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan. We have the instruction from God about the priest and about where they're supposed to stand. And we have this again, then being told by Joshua to the people, and then it actually happened. And then we have the very beginning. And what I did here basically is I cut up verse 1 in chapter 4, when all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan. And then I continue directly to verse 4. Then Joshua called the 12 men from the people of Israel, whom he had appointed, a man from each tribe. And Joshua said to them, pass on before the ark of the Lord your God into the midst of the Jordan, and take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder. Okay, according to the number of the tribes, etc. And then we see that they passed over the Jordan. Okay, and we end up in verse 8. Okay, and the people of Israel did just as Joshua commanded, took up 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, etc. We have that. And then again, I take verse 15 and put it before 15 and 16 and put it before verse 11. And the Lord said to Joshua, command the priest bearing the ark of the testament to come up out of the Jordan. So Joshua commanded the priest come up out of the Jordan. And when all the people had finished passing over the ark of the Lord, the priest passed over before the people. Okay, because they've already gotten that instruction. Then we have the continuation, the sons of Reuben, the sons of Gad, etc. And verse 14, on that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel. They stood in awe of him, just as they stood in awe of Moses all the days of his life. And then we continue on to the end of chapter 4. Okay. Now I'm going to get to the stones and what the stones were and all that stuff in a minute. But I'm going to ask now a question. I think you will probably agree with me that the way I have reordered these verses makes a lot more sense, because we have in each case God making a commandment, Joshua then taking that commandment and doing with it what he's supposed to do, whether he commands the nation, commands the priest, commands the 12 men. Okay. And then we have the actual performance. The priests do what they're supposed to do. The 12 men did what they're supposed to do. And they cross the Jordan, and all makes a lot of sense. So, again, as I said, because I don't believe that this is random, and I don't believe it's some sloppy editor that put these verses in bad order, to me, this is written on purpose, written in bad order on purpose. So what we have to ask ourselves is, what is accomplished if we take this out of order? Okay, I'm going to go back again to the beginning. And I'm going to summarize. I mean, if you want to follow the text, great. If not, not. But basically what happens when I follow the original commandment is that, for example, let's look at chapter 3, verse 5. Okay. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant, pass on before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. Okay. That is a unit in and of itself. Okay, chapter 3, from verse 1 through verse 6, we have a consistent story of Joshua without God. God has been removed. Joshua, of course, says, the Lord will do wonders among you. But what we are missing, we have a consistent story, and there's only one thing missing. The fact that somewhere in the middle there, God told Joshua what he's supposed to say or do. And the impression, therefore, that is created here is of a Joshua who is an independent leader, a Joshua who takes the reins and knows exactly what they need to do. And at the end of these, and this is what he tells them to do. Okay. And we see that consistently in each part. If we look starting from verse 9, chapter 3, verse 9, and Joshua said to the people, and he goes on and tells them exactly what to do. And then we only have at the end of the story, oh, by the way, you need to know that it's God who told Joshua he's supposed to do this with the 12 men and the stones and all that stuff. Okay. And the same thing afterwards. If I look at verse 9, verse 10. Okay, and I have it ending. The priest bearing the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan. Okay, and the Lord until everything was finished, the Lord had commanded Joshua to tell the people. And I continue, when all the people had finished passing over the ark of the Lord, the priest passed over before the people. Okay, we have this story, the sons of Reuben, all about 40,000 ready for war, passed over before the Lord for battle to the plains of Jericho. What I have there is a consistent story of success that is human, that is Joshua staying positioned there at the leadership of the people. He's directing traffic, okay, and God is not getting involved in the middle, okay? And I think that, of course, but on the other hand, God is not left out, because at the end of each section, we have what God had specifically told Joshua. But instead of interrupting Joshua's leadership with an instruction from God, we have an interrupted flow of Joshua's leadership. And so this tells me that there's a reason here. And I would like to go back to some verses that we didn't pay that much attention to, but I'd like to focus on them now. And I know it's a little complicated. I'm trying to build a full story. I will tie this all together. Let's go back to Joshua 1. Joshua 1, verse 2, okay, starting with there. God is speaking to Joshua. This is how the book opens. And he's giving him encouragement. And what does he say? My servant Moses is dead. Prepare to cross the Jordan together with all this people. It goes on and continues. And then he says on verse 5, no one shall be able to resist you as long as you live. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not forsake you or forsake you. Okay? What he is doing here is he's number one saying, Joshua, I promise you, your stature in the eyes of the nation will be as Moses. I will be with you, but your stature in the eyes of the people will also be as Moses. No man will be able to resist you as long as you live. And I think here you can interpret, what man are we talking about? Very often it's assumed that we're talking about the enemies that he's coming to attack. But I think you may also read it as saying no man in Israel. There will be no challenge within the nation to your leadership, Joshua. And this is something that God is promising. Same as with Moses. Moses was the undisputed leader of the nation. So to you will be the undisputed nation of the nation. And then look at verse 7. In verse 7, now we're moving on to chapter 3. Chapter 3, verse 7, what does God say? On this day, for the first time, I will exalt you in the sight of all Israel, so that they shall know that I will be with you as I was with Moses. That's stage 2. God first promises initially in a general way. And here God says, this day. What do you mean this day? As we cross the Jordan, something will happen that will exalt you so that they shall know that I will be with you as I was with Moses. Your stature as a leader for the nation will be undisputed and amazing, even as Moses' stature was with the nation. And finally, in chapter 4, verse 14, we have at the conclusion, on that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they stood in awe of him, just as they had stood in awe of Moses all the days of his life. Now, I contend that what God is doing here, and the way this is written in the chapter, is to emphasize this. God is not only here, it's kind of interesting, because very often we're used to God, you know, performing miracles. And the point is that so the nation or the world or whoever should see God's hand. Here, God has said from the beginning, the point is not for the nation to see my hand. The point is for the nation to see you, Joshua, and understand that you are the leader. Now, why is this so important? Because Joshua has to step into Moses' shoes. That is not simple. And it could not have been simple. We noticed at the end of chapter 1, where already the tribes, the 2.5 tribes, basically say to Joshua, okay, we'll follow you so long as God is with you. They're testing Joshua. And God is making it very clear here through these three stages, these statements that he makes. This is what I will do in general. This is what I will do today. And at the end of that day, this is what was accomplished, that this is part of the point. And therefore, in writing the chapters in the way they wrote them, it is to provide an uninterrupted, each section, uninterrupted Joshua's leadership. Now, it's important for us as the readers to know that Joshua's not acting on his own, that God is giving him these instructions, and therefore it's put in so that we know it. But by reading it uninterrupted without the instruction in the middle, there's an impression created that it is Joshua who is the leader. Joshua is commanding the Levites. Joshua is commanding the priests. Joshua is taking the 12 men. He's telling them what to do with the 12 stones, etc. And I think this is an approach to, I know it's probably a very new approach to most of you, if not all of you, this approach, but I think it's a brilliant approach to understand that sometimes things are out of order and sometimes things don't make sense, but there's a rhyme and a reason to it all. And when we understand that, we have a richness to the message of this text way beyond anything we could have gotten otherwise. Now, before I finish, I just want to mention one thing about the stones, because this is something that very often is also in and of itself is confusing. So if we look at chapter 4, verse 8. Let's start at the beginning where we first meet the stones. Chapter 4, verse 5. Joshua said to them, take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of tribes of the people of Israel. And then it makes it very clear that this is for historical, this is for posterity, so that when the children say, what are these stones? You'll be able to say of the miracle of the water stopping as we crossed the Jordan. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever. That's the end of verse 7. Okay. And then in verse 8, that's exactly what they do. They took up 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan. Okay. And they carried them over with them to the place where they lodged. In Hebrew, it's to the hotel, literally to the inn. And it's I don't think it means literally an inn. I think it means to their encampment. In other words, it's not right there at the banks of the Jordan. It's taking it to where they settled for that night, okay? And laid them down there. So we have this picture, don't forget, the Ark of the Covenant, the priests are standing in the middle of the Jordan, right where the water stopped. The nation is then crossing and passing by the Ark, crossing to the other side. And it's only after they pass to the other side, then the priest and the ark passes. But it's at that very place of the split, okay, where the ark is parked during the crossing. It's at that place that these 12 people take the 12 stones out of the Jordan, and they take him someplace, and they set up a memorial. But then we have here in verse 9, and Joshua set up 12 stone in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant stood, and they are there to this day. So now I ask you a question. Did the 12 men take the stones to somewhere else out of the river? Or did Joshua take the stones and set up a memorial in the middle of the water? Now, most people explain this as being two different memorials. And I think this is also very interesting because it reflects a certain conflict. On the one hand, when you make a memorial, when you make some kind of a sign, you want it to be exactly where the miracle happened. Where the miracle happened is in the middle of the Jordan. The Jordan was dry so that the nation could walk by. Now, some of you have been at Kasser El Yehud. I've taken some of you. Others of you have been on tours. It's a fabulous place. It is right there. We think, we know, right there where this happened. Now, if you go down there today, you see this little trickle of the Jordan. We don't even know where the 12 stones are that was in the Gilgal. We have no idea. That's gone. But I'm sure it was there for a very long time, for you know, many decades, if not centuries. But certainly there's nothing in the middle of the Jordan River. And even if it was, could we see it? I mean, as soon as this passage was over, the water covered it. Gone. I mean, let's say it's still there. But you know, the scripture says it was still there to this day, but we can't see it because it's been recovered by the Jordan. On the other hand, the stones that get taken out of the river are placed on dry land in a place where people will always be able to see them. Now, I think that that's really, there's this conflict. Do we place it exactly where it happened? But if we put it where it happened, the river's going to cover it, won't be able to see it. On the other hand, if we take it out and place it where we're going to lodge, at the hotel, at the Gilgal, whatever, that's not where it happened. And so hereby, he does it twice. There's two different ones. One we won't see, but in the place, and one we will see that's a little bit someplace else. Okay. And when it says they are there to this day, I'm not sure which of those 12 stones he's talking about. Personally, I think they are there to this day refers to what's going on in verse 8. And they carried them over to the place where they lodged and laid them down there. Okay. Although we learn later on that they placed them at the Gilgal. In verse 20, and those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. So it could be Gilgal is the place that they where they laid them down to begin with. Maybe he moved them again. I don't know. But I think this idea of they are there to this day is not really referring to what's in the water. Nobody knows what's in the water. But it's added onto that verse. It could really, you know, they are there to this day can easily refer to what's in 8 or what's in 9 because it's a continuation. Okay. And it's not clear, and I think it's purposely vague, as if to combine the two. The actual memorial is in the Gilgal, on shore, in a place where you set up memorials. It's easier. It's a good place, okay? On the other hand, we have to remember that the miracle didn't happen in Gilgal. The miracle happened in the middle of the Jordan. And in this way, scripture, by putting these two together, helps us understand the importance of understanding really what the miracle was. The Jordan split. Let us remember as we look at the Jordan, even though we can't see the dry land anymore, we can't see those 12 stones anymore, we remember that this is where it happened. And what helps us remember where it happened is because in the Gilgal, there is the monument of the 12 stones. That's all I have today. We have now, I would say, finished chapters 3 and 4. If any of you have any questions, I didn't go through everything on chapter 4, but I think you know, you got the gist of it. We've spent time on it. If you have any questions or something you'd like us to review next week, chapter 4, that's fine. But from my perspective, I will take up next week, beginning with chapter 5. Anybody have any comments or questions? Open your mics. Love to hear from you.
Sandra, with the memorial, I guess I've always thought that that would be a... like where they would sacrifice or where they would, you know, make an offering to God. Would that be true or would it just be a memorial?
Okay, now that's very interesting. There's no evidence here in scripture that there's an altar there of any kind. However, modern archaeology has told us something that we didn't know in scripture. And this is very interesting. The word Gilgal, okay, the way it's used here, we assume that it is a particular place. We know it's in the Jordan Valley and it's somewhere west of the Jordan River, but down there in the valley somewhere, okay? Now, there was an archaeologist named Adam Zartal, who one of the things he studied was this idea of a Gilgal, and he came forward with a theory. And this is a theory, you can accept it, you can reject it, but this is what he said. First of all, he noted the use of the word foot, the sole of your foot. And there's a number of times, both in Joshua and when talking about this back in Deuteronomy, where God says, where you place your foot, I will give you the land, where you place your foot. And he discovered in an area near Argaman, which is just north of the place of where they would have crossed, it's north of Jericho in the Jordan Valley. And he found this place, and I've been there, I've seen it. It's really quite amazing. We actually have a virtual tour that does this, so you might want to look up on our website, is this huge like area that is marked by small stones, original stones from ancient times, that is the shape of a footprint. Okay. And so he found similar things like this in different places. And what he said was he thinks this is a Gilgal, that a Gilgal is not a particular place. A Gilgal is a place of worship marked by a footprint. And that gives extra meaning to this God using where you place your foot, that this became a symbol of this is our land. This is we are taking possession. This is what God promised us. And they would create a place of worship, in, not a temple, okay, just a place of worship in a place that, and they would then create a footprint. Okay, wow. So what he therefore was saying, he connects the idea of a Gilgal with a place of worship. But we don't see evidence of that here in the scripture, that it's actually a place of worship. No. But it may have been. I don't know.
Yeah. Interesting. Sandra, yes. I was just kind of amazed at the difference of the splitting of the water. When they went through the Red Sea, the water was in heaps on either side. But the Jordan being a flowing river, the water was stopped and built up.
And, right. In other words, it stops on one side.
Yes.
But we don't know assume what happened was from that point, the water had already proceeded
it
down,
already so it passed dry. yes right. So it was right. Dry and it just totally dried up, let's say,
right. That side dried, yeah. And the other side is the
it
wall.
Was just but as the water you, kept did flowing
did the flow of the water stop at the same point, so you had the initial wall and then it just stopped for a while. I mean, it would have taken them time to cross the river. They were millions of people.
It says somewhere where it at some point that it stopped, and it seemed to be rather
far. It says here, it's on chapter 3, verse 16. This is how it's described.
Yes, yes.
The waters coming down from upstream piled up in a single heap a great way off at Adam, the town next to Zartan, and those flowing away downstream to the sea of the Arava, which could be the Dead Sea, actually, is what mm-hmm. it says, mm-hmm. ran out completely, so the people crossed near Jericho. So it just seemed to be that it continued to pile up, whereas yes. the other ones escaped, and then they just went.
Yeah. Right, right.
Right. And then it talks about that they passed in dry land.
Yes, yes.
Right. It's hard for us to visualize sometimes. We can visualize, but it's hard to imagine, you know? But yeah, it was a miracle, no question. And it was a miracle. All right. Yes, Liz, you want to say something?
You asked the question, why, what's the understanding of these things being told twice? And I'd wondered whether there was a sense in it that Joshua had instinctively known what to do, and then when God actually said it, it was confirming him that he the confidence thing that we've seen that wasn't there from the beginning, that he's needed the encouragement, that he's been told to be strong and courageous. And I just wondered if
that's possible. You can certainly say that. Although it's not like God said to him, you did right. Okay. God talks to him as if he's giving him a commandment to begin with, you know, as if Joshua's hearing it for the first time. You know, this is what you need to do. And then, but he's already done it, you know. Yeah. So that's why I think there's a question here of it's written out of chronological order in order to create to give us another message or to create another impression. Okay. Anyway, so it was great seeing you all, and we'll sign out now. But if you want to continue thinking about this, please email me. I'd love to hear from you if you have further questions or ideas. And we can continue discussing by email, or if it's something that I think is something we all need to talk about, we'll take it up again next week. Be well. Okay. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you.
Until next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.